1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Welcome back, Higher Side Chatters. You know the routine. Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood. Today we're going to be talking about the reptilians, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, from the sneaky serpent in the Garden of Eden and the dragons of ancient Chinese lore, to the spirit guides of the ayahuasca journey in the true form of the Queen of England, the reptile archetype has been woven into human history and culture like brass bells on your favorite Christmas sweater. And today's guest, Scott Roberts, wrote the book on it, appropriately titled The Secret History of the Reptilians. Scotty, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, thanks for having me.
Of course, man. It's a real pleasure to have you here. I enjoyed the book. Reptilian stories are definitely a guilty pleasure of mine, and I loved the all-encompassing approach, covering everything from various serpent deities of religion and mythology right up to the red-headed stepchild of modern-day conspiracy world, the dark agenda of the reptilian overlords.
Yes, the vicious, almost serendipitous reptilians.
Yeah, and you know, I was also pleasantly surprised to see that Philip Coppens had written the foreword to your book. I was a huge fan of his. I actually was lucky enough to have him on the show about a year ago, and he was so damn cool. And then we actually had another interview scheduled when his Lost Civilization Enigma book came out last fall, and you know, we missed each other on Skype, and a few hours later he emailed me saying he was going to urgent care, and I kept up with that battle through social media, and I was shocked when he was unable to recover, you know?
You know, Philip was a friend of mine, and he wrote this foreword for me. When I first asked him, Philip, will you write a foreword on a book I'm writing on the reptilians? He goes, oh, he says, I don't know, Scotty. I have to see what you're going to say about this book. And I said, trust me, it's right down your alley. And I sent him, all I sent him was the introduction to the book, and he wrote back within hours, and he said, oh, absolutely. And he sent me off his foreword. And he was at the Paradigm Symposium last year. We had a little book release party for him there. For the Lost Civilization Enigma. And, of course, within 2 months, he had passed. And so on December 30th, he was going to be back this year to this year's Paradigm Symposium. And his wife, Kathleen McGowan, best-selling author, she's going to be here in his place, so to speak. And she's going to be delivering our keynote address this year.
Yeah, for those who don't know, the Paradigm Symposium is a, obviously it's like a conference of sorts. It's with a bunch of lectures. Giorgio Tsoukalos is there. A lot of people who have been on this show are going to be there. Nick Redfern and Marie D. Jones are a couple of them. But tell us about, when does that start? When does that go off?
That's going to be October 17th through the 20th this year. And it's here in Minneapolis. And we have some of the speakers back from last year. You mentioned Giorgio Tsoukalos will be here. We have Marie D. Jones and Larry Flaxman, Laird Scranton, Dan Madsen, who you may not recognize his name off the top, but if you ever saw the Star Trek Communicator magazines and the Lucasfilms magazines and the Star Wars and Lord of the Rings magazines, he did all that. He was the publisher of all of that. And so he will be back. Some of the new faces that are coming, we have Robert Bavall, who is, you've seen him on Ancient Aliens on rare occasions, but he is an Egyptologist. You've probably seen him all over the History Channel and different documentaries out there on Egypt and ancient Egypt. And we've got Scott Walter, who is with the new show on H2 this year, which has been renewed for this next year, America Unearthed. And he's going to be coming and speaking. If you haven't seen the show, he goes through all these different finds in America, archaeological finds, and he examines those. And he's got some pretty amazing theories going on, really, who came to America first. And it's pretty neat stuff. He is a forensic geologist by trade, so knows his material. We've got Dr. Robert Schock, who teaches at Boston University. You've seen him on Ancient Aliens and other shows. He wrote the book a few years ago on the water damage to the Sphinx. What he feels is water damage as opposed to sand or erosion. Trying to think who else. L.A. Marzulli, who wrote the New York Times bestselling trilogy on the Nephilim. and does the Watchers series now. And I'm trying to think off the top of my head because I don't have it in front of me. We've got a few other names that are new. Just go check it out, ParadigmSymposium.com, and we've got tickets for sale there too.
Yeah, it does seem like a great lineup. I would advise anybody who can take the time to go have a little vacation because it seems pretty awesome. I myself was going to, I'm still considering picking up a vendor's booth because I have a conspiracy-themed t-shirt company, and I thought maybe I could come out there and sell some t-shirts.
Well, I know the boss, so you give me a call.
Hey, all right. That's awesome. Well, hey, you know, let's talk about you, man. From what I understand, you got a pretty extensive history of religious and biblical study, both formal and informal, right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I kind of started out my adult career. I was in Bible college, then I went on to seminary and to get my Master of Divinity, and I never finished that degree. I ended up taking a job out of town because prior to all that, when I was in high school, I started working as an artist in a graphic shop, a small print shop. We're talking the late 70s, so we're talking old school stuff.
Right on.
And drawing book covers and stuff like that, and running the big litho cameras. And I went on from there into advertising to really support myself when I was going to seminary. And I took a job out east and was going to go back to school. And, of course, you know how that goes. I'm going to quit this year, and I'm going to go back once I get established out east.
Of course.
And I just never got back into school, and I spent the next 20, 25 years in advertising. And so that's what I've been doing. I've been a creative director, an art director, an illustrator, a designer, a digital artist, a photographer, a writer, all the kind of a jack of all creative trades through most of my life. But at the same time as I was doing all of this, I would be in different churches I was in. I was very much into, of course, you know, when you go to seminary and Bible college, you're into your faith, so to speak. And so I was a youth pastor through the 80s and part of the 90s. And I moved to Detroit for a while, took a position in an ad agency, and was also the full-time youth pastor at our church. And so I always kept my hand in it, but through all of that, I had questions, I had things I couldn't find answers to, and things when I'd start to research answers for them seemed to draw me further and further away from biblical source points. And so I started to drift away a little bit, and I wanted to find out the questions to some of these things that I could not get answers for, or that I would get pet answers for. Things that when I was in seminary and I'd ask the questions, I'd be told I was a troublemaker. And, right. You know, sometimes tongue-in-cheek, sometimes very serious, I was told that. And I drifted more and more away from the church, away from seminary, and started trying to research some things on my own, got into other things. And I was just told by a good friend of mine, Father Jack Ashcraft, totally different denomination than I was in. I was in a very conservative, fundamentalist Baptist setting.
Wow.
Evangelical. But Father Ashcraft and I are good friends. And he said, you're going through what we call the dark night of the soul. He says it's that searching, trying to find the answers. He said, I think you'll come back around. And we'll see. But I've written the book on the Nephilim last year, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. Mm-hmm. And then this book on the reptilians is kind of, we've made it really a set by design of the book covers, by content. They really segue one off the other. And there is a lot of connectivity there in the theories. And so I've written those two books. This book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, it's subtitled appropriately, The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent Throughout Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. And it's funny. I wrote that book, and I finished that book last August or September. And then within a couple of months, had gotten a contract through New Page Books for my new book, which I'm co-authoring with Dr. John Ward. And we're actually in the midst of our final deadline now. The book manuscript is all due to the publisher next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Exodus Reality. And it's subtitled Uncovering the Real Historical Moses, Identifying the Pharaohs, and Examining the Exodus from Egypt.
Interesting.
I went over to Egypt in January for about a month, and Dr. John Ward. He's a good friend of mine. He's a British archaeologist that lives there. He and his associate, Dr. Maria Nilsson, have the Sirius Project, and they also are officially working for the government of Egypt on the quarries of Gebel El Silsila, and which is down south of Luxor before you get down to Aswan.
Nice.
And so I went over and we went to all these sites related to what we're writing about. And he and I have two different theories on who Moses was, and but we kind of merge when it comes to the Exodus, Mount Sinai, all of these places. We got to do things when we were on that trip that helped bolster this particular book. We just as a quickie, we drove over into the Sinai, and we wanted to see a mountain that we both believe is the holy mountain of God, or Mount Sinai, mentioned in the book of Exodus. And we got over into the Sinai, and we were the guests of Sheikh Barakat of the region there, and he a Bedouin family and tribe, and they put us up in a big Bedouin tent for the night on the desert floor.
Nice.
And we stood there in the moonlight that night and just saw the silhouettes of the mountains around us, and said, you know, this is where it happened. And we also climbed the mountain of Serebet El Khadim, which at the top of that mountain sits the 4,000-year-old ruins of the Temple of Hathor. And Hathor was, and you'll see the immediate connection to the Exodus, Hathor was the calf goddess, or the cow goddess of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of the golden calf story and what they were doing while Moses was up in the mountain, you get an idea
right. Of
some of why we placed this mountain. And so it was an interesting trip. And I'll tell you this, when I started doing interviews on the Reptilian book back in February, had to get my head back into it because we were already very deep into the new book, The Exodus, and it's just all consuming. And so I think I'm on mark today.
But, right on. Well, let's talk about the book a little bit. You know, one thing that's talked about in your book, and Philip did touch on this when he was here, was the misleading translations of Zachariah Sitchin and how much damage it did or didn't do to the ancient alien theory. But what's your opinion on that? Because he's sort of credited as popularizing it, but even the accepted interpretations of the Sumerian text still contain a lot of that Children of the Gods material, don't they?
Yes, it does. And I think what it is that Zechariah Sitchin, you hate to say I'm going to discredit this man's whole body of work because he mistranslated things. I am one who wants to say he was on to something. He had some great ideas. He had stuff that he put forward. But ideas are ideas, and that's all they are unless you can substantiate them. And it's the same with the ancient alien theory and all of this, is that sometimes some of these things don't even reach theory status because they really have no evidence to examine. And it's just ideas and putting forth, I can create a great account or a great story of how I think things took place and be very sincere about it, but maybe have no evidence at all to back it up, which makes it very hard to be accepted by the academic community, who I get in constant arguments with, and the scientific community, who say, well, you can't have an idea. You can't even propose an idea without evidence.
Right.
And I said, I disagree with that. You can have an idea. I said, where do you think, you know, the idea that, hey, this stuff we breathe, I'll bet you there's something more to it. There's got to be some chemical compound to it. And by, you know, the definition of science, oxygen could not have possibly existed before we were able to break down the compound.
Right, you need that curiosity.
Right, the curiosity has to be there. Well, with Sitchin, there were so many places where he tried to squeeze very large square pegs into very small round holes. And, you know, he successfully pounded those pegs in, but some of his translation work of ancient linguistics was off. And it was off enough where you can say, it's kind of like this. When I named my now 3.5-year-old son, I named him Flynn. And I wanted to find out what the meaning of the name Flynn was before we tacked it onto his birth certificate.
Of course.
And so I'm looking at the name Flynn, and it says, son of the red-haired man. And I thought, well, I don't have red hair. Is it a problem that I name him that? Then you look further and it said, son of the red-haired king. And I said, well, I could drop the red-haired part and say, I'm the king of my family. And then I saw one person had put in there, it means son of fire, son of thunder, son of the fiery victorious king. And I said, oh, there it is. I'm grabbing that one. And I don't know if that was an accurate definition at all, but the same thing that Sitchin did. He did that similar type of thing with linguistics. He found words and they didn't quite mean what he thought they meant, but he made them work. Like the word moo, M-U. That word is a word that he used to describe the children of the fiery rockets. Now, the problem with that is that moo has a definition of being conical, and that's where he got, the nose cone of a rocket. Mm-hmm. But this conical definition means the conical sphere of the firmament in the sky. And so he thought, conical, rocket, coming from the sky, children of the fiery rockets. There's no connotation to the word that denotes fiery, but the word moo could be used to describe the sky, the blue of the sky, the clouds in the sky, the rain in the sky. So he stretched it to mean it could mean the children of the fiery rockets. Problem is that particular word had nothing to do with rocket ships. And there were a couple of other places where he made stretches like this of language. And the other problem was, the ancient Sumerians and Akkadians actually left a lexicon of words in the cuneiform tablets where other languages of the region were compared. And the definition for mu was there. He just didn't research that far. And so that's where the problem lies with Sitchin, is not so much that he didn't have ideas that may have worked, but that he pushed things to work too. He went past the envelope with them. And that, to me, I ask the question in this book on reptilians. I say, does that then discredit everything he does? And I say, I have to say, from an academic standpoint, yes, mm-hmm. it does. Mm-hmm. If you're that off in – and that's just one word. But if you're that off, what does that do to the rest of the view of your scholarship in trying to find the answers to the questions?
Agreed.
And so I looked into that. And I have to do the same thing with Moses. And I just wrote this morning in one of the sections of the book, clarifying something. I said it's interesting when you have a story that comes from the Bible or any other source, and it's just a legend or a mythological tale. Take the Anunnaki, for example, apply it into this. If there is no direct evidence, which for the Exodus and Moses there is not, there is no piece of direct evidence out there that has been discovered. So what you have to do is you have to go to then secondary archaeological evidence to see if the story in the Bible is plausible. Same thing with Sumerian cuneiform tablets. They're legends, they're mythologies, they're religious mythologies. So you need to go, if there is no direct evidence out there stating that the Anunnaki were reptilians and were gods and so on, you have to say, it didn't exist that way until I can find something that makes it work, or I need to go to secondary archaeological historical evidence to see if there is a plausible fit. Mm-hmm. And so that's what needs to be done with all of this material. And I know Sitchin didn't do that.
Sure. Well, let's talk about what is in there. You know, what do they actually say? Because they do still have some pretty compelling information, you know, about the rebel god of Enki being appointed to create humans. And it's also funny that when you look at, like, when scholars translate old texts, it's like if it seems pretty run-of-the-mill and normal, then it would be history. But if it seems fantastical, then it would be religion. It's kind of funny how they just have two separate categories based on, you know, how they perceive what they're reading.
I would agree with you on that. I think what you've got in the story, you have to go, first of all, back to the cuneiform texts. I don't read cuneiform. I'll be very honest with you. I have not made a life and career of ancient Middle Eastern linguistics, so I have to rely on those who have. And I picked up a book that is the ancient Mesopotamian mythologies and stories as translated as recently as about 15 to 20 years ago by Stephanie Daly. You can pick this book up anywhere. And she has just simply gone to the cuneiform texts and interpreted them or translated them directly into more modern English so we can understand that. And newer, if you will, scholarship on the linguistics of those periods. And so what I did was I went there and I read the stories, and you find that – and by the way, these stories are exciting. I remember I'm laying in bed one night with a small lamp on, and I'm reading this book, and it's about 2 a.m. I woke up my wife, and I said, Rainey, you have got to hear this. Listen to this story. And she sat up, much to her credit, on her elbow with her chin in hand, and listened, and very intently, and she gave me a quick, that's fascinating. And she said, I'm going back to sleep now. So, but it's fascinating stuff when you start reading the interpretation. They sound very biblical, like biblical legends, biblical mythologies, biblical accounts. When you get to the tale of Atrahasis, the human king who is looking for freedom from the gods, they're under this yoke of bondage to Elil, the chief god of the Anunnaki. And he prays to the patron god of his city, Eridu. And he prays to Enki, who is also known as Ea, but he prays and he says, Lord Enki, he says, hear the words of your servant, your betrodden servant, and do bend your ear to us and bow down and release us from this heavy yoke of bondage. And Enki hears his cry and says, I will bend down my ear to you. You are my faithful servant, Atrahasis, and I will come down and I will deliver you. And this is the kind of text that's written there. And it's very poetic, the way it's written as well. And so to back this up a little bit, though, go back a little further. You've got Elil, who is the chief god of the Anunnaki. Nowhere in any of these cuneiform texts does it say that the Anunnaki are reptilian in nature. There is nowhere it says that. But what they've done, the people who are proponents, Zechariah Sitchin, they have extrapolated that information from other source points that talk of reptilian connections, little reptilian statuettes, things like this that they assume are the Anunnaki. There's a lot of stretching and a lot of squeezing and a lot of fitting to make these theories work. One of the basic theories that they go to is that Enki, Ea, who comes to deliver the humans from the bondage to the gods, and he's one of the gods himself, he's an Anunnaki god, and he lives in the great Abzu, the underground, underworld sea, and he comes up to the Euphrates River backwaters, all the marshes around the city of Eridu, where he is the patron god. And he rides in his boat and loves this place. And it's known as the Serpent's Marsh because it's filled with serpents. And it still is today if you go to that region around the ancient city of Eridu. And he is then quickly associated with the Serpent Marsh. It becomes known as the Serpent's Den, Ea's Den, and which there's some obvious connections to biblical stories there with that word. Ea's Den eventually becomes known as Eden. And the interesting story is this. Elil, chief of the Anunnaki gods, just like Zeus is the chief god of the Olympians. This is their pantheon of gods. He says, we're so tired of digging our own trenches and our own canals and tilling our own ground and harvesting our own crops and mining our own resources. Let us therefore, and it says exactly this in the translation, let us therefore create primeval man to do our work for us. And he conscripts Enki, Ea, and Enki gets a Betlit, I can't ever pronounce her name unless I've got it in front of me, the goddess, and they create primeval mankind, humanity, to be a slave race to the Anunnaki. And then, as I mentioned, Atrahasis calls out after some time, says, please take this yoke of burden off of us. Enki hears his cry, comes down to the city of Eridu with his mighty men of valor, and they teach Atrahasis and the humans how to rebel against the gods and fight for them. And Atrahasis and the humans win their freedom from the Anunnaki. And Enki is then, because of this deed, he and all of his godly followers are condemned by the chief god Elil to dwell in the subterranean caverns of the earth forever as punishment. Excuse me. Now, fast forward about 1,500 years to the writing of the book of Genesis. I believe Moses wrote the book of Genesis, and without getting into what I'm writing about in this new book, there's a lot of proof for Moses being an actual person, and I don't believe there's any reason to doubt the tradition on that of three major religions of the world. Let's say Moses wrote the Pentateuch. He was just another guy in history, and he wrote and founded the Jewish religion and really built religion out of nothing. And I believe he borrowed a lot from the Egyptian culture, and he borrowed a lot from the Sumerian culture. Listen to the similarities in this story. As we know from the Genesis account, that God created Adam and Eve, placed them in the garden to do what? It says, and God placed Adam and Eve in the garden to till the ground and keep it for him.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of conscripting or creating them as slaves and making them do the work, he puts them in paradise where they're doing the work anyway.
Right.
Then you have, in the Sumerian story, you've got Enki, Ea, who comes and delivers the people from slavery. Now, all of this, by the way, is a migration of religion from the Fertile Crescent up around what is now Iraq. They move down into the Canaanite region, which becomes Israel later. But the Canaanites pick up the names. The chief god of the Anunnaki, Elil, becomes El of the Canaanites, E-L. And the Hebrews pick that up. That's the definition. That's the Hebrew word for God, is El, coming from the more ancient Elil in the Sumerian culture. El is the same God that you find in words like Elohim and El Shaddai and El Elyon, all these names of God in the Hebrew Old Testament. Enki, Ea, the migration of religion brings his name down into the Canaanite culture, and Ea becomes the base word for Yahweh, which is Jehovah in the Jewish religion. So the names of the Anunnaki gods just migrate down into new religion and are borrowed, and they become the names of the gods in the Jewish cast of gods, if you will. It's almost as if Elohim, God among many, God of gods, he is a different character than Jehovah, but they're made to sound synonymous in the English Bible. And they're two different characters. The migration of this story then goes this way. When God creates Adam and Eve, puts them in the garden, there is a serpent character. The
right.
Serpent in the Garden of Eden. We were all taught that was who? Satan,
of course, the devil,
Lucifer. Well, he's never called that in the passage. It's 1,000 years later before the name Satan is even attributed to the serpent in the garden. And even at that, that's our interpretation of that. It's such a loose... it talks about somewhere in the prophets, the prophetic books, it talks about that old serpent in the garden. And they're relating it to Satan. Well, it could very well be, according to Jewish scripture, that that's who that is. But he's not called that in the Garden of Eden story. He's known as Nakosh. If you look at the Hebrew for the serpent, it's Nakosh. And Nakosh, by definition, means bringer of forbidden knowledge. Bringer of knowledge, mm-hmm. Bringer of illumination, the illuminated one, the trickster, the bringer of chaos. And chaos, by the way, isn't necessarily a negative word in ancient linguistics. It just means that the one who delivers this knowledge and illuminates, that the result can be a chaotic set of circumstances.
Right. Like the trickster archetype that we hear about.
Yes. As a matter of fact, trickster is one of the definitions.
Right.
And he's very similar to, look at the, and I cite this one in the book, the Lakota, the Native American story of creation, how the man and the woman rise up out of the subterranean caverns of the earth and see light for the first time. And Iktope, the trickster character, a god, falls in love with their daughter and impregnates her, and she has, I think it's triplets or quadruplets, something like that. The same thing in the Garden of Eden story. I believe the story is not one of being tempted to eat forbidden fruit. It is an allegorical tale. You can look at it as literal if you want, but it's an allegorical tale. And by the way, all of this fits into just examining different creation stories and the basis for this reptilian notion.
Mm-hmm. All the parallels are pretty staggering.
Yeah, the parallels are mind-blowing. As a matter of fact, when I first researched this out, I sat back in my chair and I had, you know, holy Shiite. And I'm reading through these accounts, and it appears to me from all accounts, when you get out of a simply evangelical or Jewish mode, a synagogue and a Sunday school mode, and you start digging into these texts, you find that the encounter between Eve and Nakosh is a lot more than simply eating fruit. It has something to do with with sexual encounter. It has to do with the impregnation of Eve. It has to do with the race interrupted from the get-go. And because it says that the serpent tempted her, which is the same word in the Hebrew for seduced. She took, she ate. All the verbs are pretty common verbs, but it ties into this whole idea of sexual encounter. She eats, she gives to Adam, he eats. And so in a sense, it's almost like there's sexual experience going all the way around here. And the result of all this is that Eve conceives. And she conceives. The Bible doesn't say twins, but you look at every other first family in creation in all different religions, and most all of them talk about either the wife of the first family or the daughter of the first family bequeathing multiples, twins, triplets, quadruplets, quintuplets, things like that, in almost every story that exists. So I extrapolated that information over and said comparative religions say that the wife of the first family, in many cases, bore multiples. Well, it says she has Cain and Abel. Mm-hmm. It never says they're twins. It just says Cain is older. And there's at least two other times in the Bible where you find that twins, significant twins, are born, and the eldest is always the one who bears the birthright, the one who was born minutes before. And the same with Cain and Abel. He's the firstborn. And I believe that the story is teaching us that Cain is the son of Eve and Nakosh, while Abel is the son of Adam and Eve. And you know the story, you know, they're giving their offerings to God, these two boys, and Abel's offering is accepted because it's blood and so on. And it ties into the fall and all of that. And while Cain's is not, so Cain murders his brother. And you see all these conversations between God and Cain, but you never see conversations between God and Abel. Now, if they ever existed in the mythology, those are lost to antiquity. But I found it very interesting that, God only spoke to Cain, but he never spoke to the righteous one, Abel. He says to Cain, Cain, you're being tempted. Sin is lying at the door. Don't murder your brother, in other words. And but you never see God saying, hey, Abel, watch out, your brother's going to kill you. There's no record of that. And then God comes to Cain after the murder. And you know, we know all the story of that. And he marks Cain, and Cain goes off to another city and marries a woman and has a child. It's like, where'd she come from? That's a totally different tributary we will not go down today. But he builds a city, and he names it after his son Enoch. It's not the Enoch of the famous book. This is nine generations earlier by biblical accounting. But he names his son Enoch, and he names a city that he built. He builds a city. City for he and his wife and his son, I guess.
Ambitious.
And very ambitious. We're going to fill these towers. But he names it after his son Enoch. Now, Enoch, linguistically, you have to trust me on this. You can look it up. Linguistically, the E becomes a U. The N becomes an R for the ancient linguistics of the languages in the area. And Enoch becomes the word Uruk. And Uruk is the name of the first city, and Uruk is the original name for Iraq. And this is where this took place, in what is now Iraq. And let's go back to the Garden of Eden story for a minute. Right after the fall, you see a passage, it's right in your English Bible. Look at Genesis 3, and it says, and God said, now the word for God being used there is the word Elohim. And Elohim is the name for God used almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament. And the name by definition means El, God, and Him, just like in, remember the Nephilim, the Him is a plural suffix tacked onto a word to denote plurality in the Hebrew language. So Elohim literally means by definition God of or among or from many gods. And it's a plural term, but it could be used singularly as well, depending on the context of the sentence you find it in. Just like our word deer, I always say deer, the singular, I see a deer in my front yard, plural, I see a group of deer, herd of deer in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And so Elohim, it says in Genesis 3, and Elohim said, the humans have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and have become just like us, plural. Let us, therefore, prevent them from also eating of the tree of life, lest they become just like us, eternal. And so they go down and they kick him out of the Garden of Eden. And at the cursing, God says to the serpent, he utters what is known as the first messianic prophecy, the prophecy of a coming Messiah. And the Christians believe, Jesus. And so the first prophecy of a Messiah comes right at the Garden of Eden. You ask any rabbinic scholar, any Christian scholar, they will concur with you that this, when God says this, he's speaking a messianic prophecy. He says to the serpent, and there, and you will bite his heel, but he will come and return and crush your head.
Damn.
It's a picture of the coming Messiah. Now, the Messiah in the Jewish sensibility, the Hebrew sensibility, was the same as what they began calling the kinsman redeemer, the one who would be one of us redeemer. And you have this all through the Old Testament. The story of the Messiah is the kinsman redeemer, the one who would be one of us that can redeem us. And when they say that over and over again, the one who is one of us, the kinsman, this is the Messiah, they're obviating the opposite. If they have to keep telling you, he's going to be one of us, he's one of us, he's from our blood, he's one of us, they're telling you, well, what's the opposite of that? That he would not be of the same blood as us.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go through all the genealogies in the Old Testament. And all the genealogies are there, and they follow the firstborn sons all the way through, all the way up to Noah, then all the way up to David, then even the followers of Jesus took Mary and traced her lineage back to David. Oh, because after the time of David, there was this added wrinkle on the Messiah that he had to be of the lineage of David, the king of Israel. So they trace him back to David, then trace David back to Noah, and trace Noah back to Adam, but not through the firstborn. They break tradition when they get all the way back to the beginning. Why? Because Cain murdered his brother? Is that the reason they don't follow the Kenite line? No. They follow the line of Seth, the thirdborn, because Cain is not of pure human blood. Cain is of the line of the serpent character Nakosh in the garden. And he is of the mixed blood, and the Messiah could never sprout from his seed. And remember when I told you the messianic prophecy in the Garden of Eden? God then looks at all of them and he says to Adam, Eve, and the serpent, and there will be constant enmity or conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, or the seed of the humans. And this sets it up for the whole Old Testament. And I would dare say that the story of the Messiah really piggybacks the story of Race Interrupted and the fact that there is a separate bloodline. Now, all of this fits under, if you take yourself out of the box and look back in, this is all religious mythology, is all it is.
Right.
But it matches up to the Sumerian mythology, or at least has similarities to the Sumerian mythology. And this mythology is followed all the way through the Old Testament. It's also followed through other cultures in the world that all have these reptilian figures at the core of their theologies, that are either out-and-out reptilian characters, or they are reptilian in nature, or they have some linkages to some reptilian god. And they're not always evil. For instance, the Chinese dragon is never shown as an evil character.
Mm-hmm.
He is always a happy. I read definitions on this. Is that he's the happy snake. He's the happy dragon, the happy reptilian. He's the one who brings fertility and love and goodness and happiness to the Chinese people. And so they were not always represented that way. But then you have other instances in history that talk about reptilian connections without mentioning reptilians. Take Krishna of the Hindu religion. It talks about him sitting atop a coiled serpent in a beautiful garden beneath a banyan tree, disseminating the forbidden knowledge of the gods. You have Quetzalcoatl, the Mayans, the feathered serpent god, who disseminates the forbidden knowledge of the gods and is condemned by the gods for his act. And this story is repeated over and over again in different religions, but connected to them all the time is this notion of the serpent character disseminating knowledge of some kind.
You know, I'm going to get weird on you here a little bit. I mean, this is something we've been dancing around on the show and exploring with different guests as I try to lay out a narrative and a theory of everything for myself, try to piece these things together. But you know, I don't know if I could be a good cheerleader for the David Icke theory of the Queen of England and the Bushes are literally reptilian shapeshifters, but I've come across many researchers who believe that at the top levels of, say, the Illuminati or Masonry or even the Catholic Church, it's a closely guarded secret that the rituals and ceremonies created for the lower levels or the masses are veiled homages to Satan or the Lightbringer or the Illuminated One. And it's kind of interesting that the snake, Nakash, is synonymous with the Illuminated One. And it's odd because the mass itself revolves around the preparation and cannibalism of a graphic human sacrifice. And then it's hidden within a lot of flowery language of standing, kneeling, and sitting. At least that's my interpretation, because it's a pretty dark ritual when you really look at what the mass is symbolic of.
And, you know, I will tell you, I'm the first one to say that I don't have any insight on the deep, dark secrets of the higher Masons.
Right.
I have lots of friends who are Masons, and I've even been asked if I wanted to become a Mason at a couple of different times.
Oh, you got to do it.
And I haven't done it. The times that I didn't do it, it wasn't because of any philosophical problem I had with them or like, oh, no, you have reptilians in your hierarchy. You know, it wasn't that was preventing me. It was just I didn't have time to do it. And I missed every time they had initial meetings. And so I've still got friends and who are Masons. And I asked them point blank. I said, do you guys eat children and goats? And the answer is always, oh, yes, we do. And of course, tongue in cheek. But if there is some deep, dark secret at the higher levels, we get those from people who say they've been there and in those positions. But I have my doubts that we really know anything for sure. Is there symbolism that might come into it? Perhaps. The illumination, of course, and you get the Illuminati out of that. And David Icke will tell you the reptilian that exists on this planet that are extraterrestrial reptilians running the planet behind the scenes are even behind the Illuminati.
Right.
And of course, you know, I say that a bit tongue in cheek, and it's like saying, you know, the Easter Bunny, he's the one who really controls the real Santa Claus. You know, and I only say it that way to illustrate the point is we don't know.
Right.
We have no idea. This is all our mythology. And what my book does is really trace the ancient mythology and religion building and how we've done the same thing in our current mythologies of the reptilians. We've created, there is a subculture of people out there, if you will, that believe in the ancient alien reptilian factor, but they don't know for sure. And they have no idea, but they believe this, and it's a belief like a religion. Do I know that Jesus is the Son of God? I don't know that. I could believe that by faith, but I have no proof of that other than what's in my heart if I'm a Christian. Same for Judaism, same for Islam, same thing. These are all religions that were built off of older religions. As a matter of fact, in fear of a fatwa, it was Muhammad that was trying to unify the Arab tribes, and they all worshipped 360 different gods at Mecca. And he had a mentor who was a Christian man, a mentor who was a Jewish man, and they told him, if you ever hope to unify your tribes and your people into one, you have to have a monotheistic religion. And this is really what Constantine was doing, the first Christian emperor of Rome. He used Christianity to do two things, establish that there is one God equals one emperor, one religion equals one empire. This is what Muhammad did. And he discarded 359 of the gods, of their pantheon of gods, and he took Hadal and raised him up and said, and renamed him Allah. And he says, this is Allah, this is our God, our monotheistic God. And he founded Islam, and he unified his people. This is what Moses did. This is what many religions builders have done throughout the millennia. And this is what you've got with, I believe, the reptilian proponents today. They're not building a religion to unify the people, but maybe not on the surface, but they have practically built religion.
Right.
They've got their own theology. They've got their own dogma, their own doctrine, if you will. That's different. You know, it doesn't save your soul or anything like that, but It's one that is all based on these old mythological notions of these mythological characters. You say the Masons, the whole Illumination thing. One thing I studied in great depth for the Nephilim book was Elohim. And we always have been taught in Judeo-Christianity that God is the one God, the monotheistic God. However, I think that's different. I think the Bible in its subtext teaches that there is a pantheon of gods in the Hebrew religion, therefore the Christian religion.
Right.
In Psalm 82, you have God, Elohim. It says, "And Elohim stood in the midst of the Elohim, and he said to them, you are all Elohim, the bright, shining, illuminated princes of heaven." And this is where we get Nakash. He's one of the Elohim, the sons of God who bequeath the Nephilim with human women. They are known in the Hebrew tongue as the Bnei HaElohim, the sons of the God of many gods, the illuminated ones.
Yeah, it's just, it is kind of weird, I mean, going back to Nakash, because it was about 1,000 years until people started attributing Satan to that, you know, snake. And that's what I wonder, is it because of manipulation, trying to create a history that's more suited for control of the masses, or was it a mistranslation? Because there's a lot of conspiracy theorists who talk about the manipulation of the masses to worshiping. They're putting their energy into a worship of Satan, which is veiled between all this mythology. And that's kind of interesting, because it comes back to the snake creature being called the Illuminated One. And then you talk about the fact that that archetype is someone who gives knowledge to the human race and elevates them to a level. And that's kind of what these dark societies try to do, is they try to they've elevated themselves to what they might consider positions of godliness.
Well, this is interesting, because with the Gnostics, the ones that don't know, they're seeking knowledge,
right?
By definition, they're the ones who will tell you that the serpent in the garden, that the sin of the serpent in the garden was delivering forbidden knowledge to the humans. And remember I told you there was that passage where Elohim says, right after the fall, the eating of the fruit, he says, they've eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Let us prevent them from eating of the other. Mm-hmm. The two questions that came out to me after that, and maybe this is from some of the Gnostic influences I read. The first question was, what did Elohim or God have against humans having knowledge?
Right.
That was the first question. The second one was, if he is saying that they could become just like him and we need to prevent that, who was he really that humans, a created being, could become just like him? And that's where some of my questions came about the, and I only use the word mythology, not to send anybody into a tizzy or ask anybody to leave their faith, but in stepping outside the box to look back in, you say this is just the Hebrew version of creation mythology. And so the question is, why is that not more clearly taught? You have to dig for that and find it hidden in the language and in comparative texts in the scripture to find that this is substantiating that story. So the Gnostics, in believing that all the serpent character was doing was illuminating the humans and helping them free themselves from the bondage of Elohim, which is exactly what Enki Ea was doing for Atrahasis in the humans. He was delivering them the knowledge and fighting for them to free themselves from the bondage of Elil. And the stories are so similar, it's crazy.
Yeah, what's the point of, say, the Catholic Church putting so much energy and emphasis on demonizing that character? That should be a character that free thinkers appreciate, which is, you know, again, getting into the higher levels of Masonry, why they might veil that type of worship, because it just seems weird that they put so much energy into demonizing that. And I think maybe it has something to do with the idea of control, and that I kind of believe that the religion was put in place for control, you know, creating the idea of heaven and earth, and saying, if you aren't listening to us and donating in this life, you know, this eternal life, this is the practice
right.
life. You're dealing with the practice life now, but this real life, let me tell you, it's going to be great as long as you give me your money and do what I say.
I'll tell you, a lot of this just ties into some of my big questions I had about evangelical Christianity. I would say if hell is a very real place taught in the Bible that you spend all of eternity in this torment and this separation from the love of God for, it's hard to wrap our brains around the word because we're finite creatures, but infinity, all of eternity existing in this tormented state. I said, why did God simply leave it up to people, human beings, finite beings, to believe a certain thing, a certain way, when it's only recorded in old scriptures, and there are hundreds of other philosophies to choose from? My big question was, if God gave us free will, we are condemned if we express that free will and practice free will. If I choose, God, I don't want to be a follower of yours. Right. Well, you've exercised your free will, but what does that do according to Christian theology? It sends you on the hell express.
And it's so a catch-22.
It's a catch-22. So what is free will really? And I kind of look at it this way. If God is who the Bible says he is, we're his anyway. He can do whatever the hell he wants with us. No pun intended there. If he owns us and owns the universe, he could wipe it out of existence in a breath, according to biblical theology. But he would be going against his own creation and structure he set in play of free will. But that free will is not something you can express and hope to be in favor with God. And so, I'm not saying that that's not my theological base. I just look at these things and I ask these questions. And this is the question you have to ask when you look at all of this. And by the way, something I forgot to mention, it just popped into my mind. There is something in the Garden of Eden story that is a clue. Even in the English language, it's a clue. If it doesn't look like total mythology to begin with or an encoded story on top of a mythological story, mm-hmm. Just look at what happened when the serpent offers her the fruit or says, you can eat that fruit. What does it say Eve does? It says she looks at the fruit and sees that it looks good to the eye. And then it goes on to say this, and she saw that it was something that would make her wise. Hmm. Now, there was a clue for me in the English language, even not even digging into the text. It's like, how often do I look at a piece of fruit and say, that looks mighty tasty, and it looks good. It looks like it'll be sweet.
Right.
And you know what? It also looks like something that's going to bring me wisdom when I eat it.
Well, what do you think she's looking at there? I mean, if it's supposed to be sexual, I mean, the dick doesn't make you wise either.
No, but I think what it is, it's knowledge. It's the increase of knowledge. The knowledge that they did not have before. What was the first thing you notice when it says that they fell? They realized that, poof, they were naked. And right. They hide from God. And who told you were naked, God asks them. You know? And so it's the revealing of things. It's the uncovering of things. And she saw that whatever this was he was offering, as symbolized in the fruit, it was going to uncover her lack of knowledge and give her wisdom and right. gain knowledge of something.
And not to harp on the same point I've been bringing up, but I mean, that's kind of mm-hmm. what the conspiracy says about the Illuminati or the Masons is that these
exactly.
top levels, they hide knowledge that they, you know, they hold that fruit that they could share, but apparently they keep to themselves.
I think that there's a lot of information that we have in our religious studies. Let's stick to Judeo-Christianity. There's a lot of things that are hidden things to us. It was very interesting. Another point on this whole flip-flopping of an idea. Remember at the Last Supper, and Judas takes off and betrays Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. And he is demonized forever as the one who betrayed the Savior. But if you go to one of the Gnostic books, the Gnostic Gospels, the Book of Judas, which was found amongst the trove of the Essenes in the caves of Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls was the Book of Judas. And when they finally translated this book, you've got Jesus at the Last Supper. Before the meal starts, he takes Judas aside. And he says to him, you of all my disciples are the one who gets it. You get the deeper mysteries. And he says, therefore, I am calling on you to help fulfill the prophecy that I would be betrayed. And that, and in the Gospel of Judas, he, of course, is rankled by this and heartbroken by this. But he does it out of altruism, following his master's command, betrays Jesus. And then he's so distraught over this, he commits suicide. But remember at the Last Supper, Jesus said, one of you is going to betray me. And all the disciples are like, oh my God, who is it? Is it me? It's not me, is it? And then it says, whoever dips his bread into the sauce with me will be the one. And it says he broke his bread and he dipped it in the sauce, and immediately Judas dipped his bread in the sauce. And Jesus looks at him and he says, go do that thing that you have been appointed to do. That's just in the Gospels that mm-hmm. exist now. People have written that off as, well, it was a fate, kind of a fateful, satanic appointment. But when you compare it to the Gospel of Judas, which was, of course, booted out of the canon of Scripture, you've got a completely different story. So what's the real answer? What's the real question? God, if God exists the way we were taught, has not made it clear. You have to believe it by faith or accept something else by faith. Or you tend to do what the atheists do or academic thinkers do. They separate themselves completely from it because they say it doesn't look like what was taught there. There's more to this story, or there's a lot less to this story. All of this is philosophy that goes into looking at the story of the reptilians. Mm-hmm. Do they exist as an alien race that came here in prehistoric times and genetically bred humans and created a slave race, and that we broke away from that slave race? According to the mythology, there was a terrestrial, earthbound race of reptilians that fought against them. And the terrestrial bound lost, and they were back into the subterranean caverns of the earth. But the conquerors, they dwell behind the scenes, and they are manipulating and controlling everything from behind the scenes.
Right. That brings us to modern day.
It brings you to modern day.
Apparently.
And all of this stuff comes up through the Merovingians. It comes up, who are the Frankish rulers in what is now France, in the 300s to the 700s. They bring in the whole serpent seed doctrine. Merovic, the founder of the Merovingians, said that he was of not only of the blood of Christ. This whole Priory of Sion issue comes in. The blood, I can't think of the word now, the blood of Christ, that Christ lived and had descendants, and that they were descended from the blood of Christ, but also from the blood of the serpent or Lucifer. He says his mother was duly impregnated and he was born. And this was done, why? Was it done because it's real, or was it done because they were just trying to control the masses with these stories, these religious stories? This all led up into, eventually this thinking led into all the thinking that's behind Lemuria, all the thinking that's behind Atlantis, this greater race theory that's out there. This was picked up by the German revivalists in the mid-1800s. And the Theosophists picked up the philosophy of the Lemurians, that there are greater spirits that guide us, the, if you will, the positive side of the Aryan race thinking, the race that is greater than us, and so on. And they taught these things. Madame Blavatsky wasn't teaching serpent seed doctrine. She was teaching, in a sense, one of your first New Agers, you know, teaching that whole theory. But then the Thule Society was founded to be a German revivalist movement, but it was two guys that were occultists that believe in this whole Lemurian thing that also incorporated into the blood of Christ issue, the Luciferian issue. They were the illuminated ones. Mm-hmm. And it was Adolf Hitler in 1919 who joined the Thule Society, and he eventually turned the Thule Society into the National Socialist Workers' Party, the Nazi Party. And these are the things that we see that have come up all the way up through history, this occult stuff, right, if you will. And it's led into, there are broken connections in here, but it's really some of the same philosophies are morphing over into new philosophies. And It's funny, there's even esoteric Nazism out there that says Hitler was actually the ghost or the spirit of Hitler. You can call upon it to empower you, just like Hitler believed that they had the ghosts and the spirits of the Atlanteans and the Lemurians and these reptilian kings that they could call on. So this is what's interesting about all of this, is how this mythology morphs from one stage to the next to the next to the next, and really it's nothing different than where it started. It's a mythology.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy because the length of time is what kind of makes it hard to believe. And I even feel the same way about, say, the Rothschild dynasty or something like that, or the history of central banking, and these people are still in control, because it's multi-generational. I mean, people only live in like 80 years, so it seems like it would be really difficult to control that amount of time. But I mean, there is a history of monarchies protecting their bloodlines, carefully planning out their lineage with no regard for incest. But you know, it's very weird. And then the Hitler stuff, he's obviously trying to engineer people or bring back some type of certain thing. But is the ruling class, were they trying to preserve a high percentage of alien blood? Also, does it really matter? Isn't it more important to ask why we've accepted a ruling class rather than their blood type anyway?
Well, that is at the core of that, too, and it's a question that doesn't get asked a lot. I find it interesting, though, before I forget to mention this, during the Exodus, there was a tribe that broke off from Moses and the rest of the Israelites, or the pending Israelites, the Hebrews, and it was the tribe of Dan, and they went to the north of Canaan, and they interbred with the tribes of the Anu, who were the remnant of the Anunnaki, according to the legend. And when you look at like Irish versions of what I call the Irish version of the Nephilim story, the Tuatha De Danann, they were the children of the goddess Danu, and they were the bright, shining kings who descended from heaven and came down, and they had wars, and then they were driven back into the hollow hills and became known as the Elven folk. And of course, the word Elven is a derivative of the word El, or Elohim. And these bright shining again, these illuminated kings from heaven, they were said to be of the tribe of the Tuatha De Danann. And the Tuatha De Danann have also been called the Tuatha De Anan, or the Tuatha De Anu, instead of the Tuatha De Anu, or Danu, the goddess Danu, they compare to the race of the Anu. And that they went north, they interbred with this tribe, and they migrated to the west. And they went through the Slavic countries and then into the European countries. And they founded all the ruling families of these countries. They founded the ruling family of Wales, the ruling family of England. They were all from this bloodline. So this is, who knows how to trace that? There is no way to trace that, but this is one of the legends, is that the Hebrews broke off and interbred with the descendants of the Anunnaki in the north of Syria and Lebanon, up in the Iraq and Iranian areas, and then moved west.
It's crazy. I mean, I love talking to people like you who've done a lot of that work and have really researched it, because, I mean, it takes half a lifetime, and, you know, you're still left without a lot of answers, and it's very frustrating for me. I mean, every day we get a little bit further and further away from that source material, so it gets lost incrementally every day. It's you know, it's pretty sad, but, I mean, we are getting towards the end of the show, and it really wouldn't be right to do a reptilian show without giving David Icke a few dedicated minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, personally, David Icke did a lot to get me into researching the alternative. When I heard him talk about Sirhan, the fallacy of the left-right paradigm, or 9/11, but I feel like he sort of presents himself as a savior archetype, which is fishy right off the bat. And
sure,
I love to listen to and talk to people who've dug through the mountains of documents to find clues of various cover-ups. But when you start talking about astral projection to Zeta Reticuli on Monday, channeling aliens on Tuesday, harnessing the power of the crystal-infused meditation circle on Wednesday, starts to make the whole thing seem a bit phony. I mean, what are your thoughts on David Icke?
Well, I didn't spend a great deal amount of time in the book on David Icke, but I did dedicate a chapter to him, which I'm sure will now place me on the list of guys that will never be able to interview him. But I have some respect for David Icke in the sense that he, if you listen to him, if you watch any of his videos online, if you've ever seen him, he would be what I would qualify as a good man because he tries to teach good things.
True.
He tries to teach you about yourself and how, but he gets a little new agey for me, which is a little too droopy and gobbledygooky for me at times.
Agreed.
But who's to say him no, if he says that your spirit has the ability to transcend to something else? Fine. Okay. Who cares? You're teaching something that I learn in church in a different way. And but when he starts getting into his theories of the reptilians, of the reptilian races, and even the Queen Mother and the Bushes and all of these are really reptilians and cloned human skin, that's the stuff where I say, I think you're taking this a bit too far. But I always have to put the caveat on it and say, but I don't know that for sure.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Maybe he's right. I just don't think he is. I think he's stretched the limits. He's done too many things in his personal credibility that really makes me want to trash almost anything he says about that stuff. Declaring himself the Son of God and a Messiah character. His turquoise phase where he went through wearing everything turquoise because it drew the right color. You know, things like that. That's kind of an odd duck in my book.
Right. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it's like Zachariah Sitchin, you know. It's like...
Right.
I mean, nobody's perfect, but you kind of got to look at the messenger and check out their credibility.
And you know what? Even the biblical patriarchs were all shown to have faults right within the scripture. They all did screwy stuff. You know, they... you think of guys like Abraham. He's promised that he will be the father of many nations and so many descendants that God had him look up at the stars one night and said, count the stars. And he said, I can't. And there's too many. And God said, this will be what your descendants are like. And here's Abraham. What is he, 110 years old? And his wife is 99.
Right, that's weird.
And
too.
It's something like that. And he's got this promise, but he has no kids. His wife is barren. And so what does he do? He goes in. He says, "Well, God said it's going to happen. I better take my wife's handmaiden and have sex with her." And
got to.
So I can have some, you know. And you sometimes wonder if this, you know, honey, did you have sex with my handmaiden? Why, yes, I did. Well, I'm going to divorce you. You can't. God promised me, and I had to do that. You know, you don't know.
Right.
It's an elaborate story built around. I'm just making a little light there on that.
Of course.
What this patriarch does is he takes matters into his own hands because he doesn't believe what God's told him. As a matter of fact, when the angels come and visit him, the men that show up, and they're angels of God. One is like unto the Son of God, is what it says. There were just guys that came by, and they predicted that Sarah was going to have a child. And Sarah was listening from behind the tent wall, and she laughs, and they hear her laugh. They said, and you'll name him Isaac. Well, what does Isaac mean in the Hebrew? It means she laughed. So it's a very interesting story there. But here's a patriarch who took matters into his own hands. And because he did this, what happened, according to the legend, the son of Hagar, his wife's handservant, who was an Egyptian, she bears Ishmael, and who is the father of many tribes, the Arabic tribes. And look at the conflict between the Arabic tribes and the Israeli tribes. And you get an idea. This is supposed to have laid the groundwork for the conflict between them all. And so it's very interesting stories. Even when you look at the patriarchs, they all did something. David, the man after God's own heart, the king of Israel. He's called the man after God's own heart, the sweet psalmist of Israel, the slayer of the giant, who is, by the way, referred to as the Nephilim, he and his three brothers, Goliath and his three brothers of Gath. And David goes and hunts them all down over the next few years and kills them all in the biblical scriptures. Very obscure, but it's there. But David, the sweet psalmist of Israel, what did he do? He has sex with Bathsheba while his soldiers are out fighting. She becomes pregnant, and what does he do? He tries to get her husband. He calls him back from the front, wants him to go home, take a vacation, you know, have sex with your wife, things like that. He's trying to get rid of this baby connection to him, how his wife could be pregnant without him being home. And he doesn't do it. He sleeps at the doorstep of David with the other soldiers on the floor because he said, how can I go home and enjoy my wife when my men can't do the same thing? And so he's so dedicated to David. So David gives the order to the general and he says, I want you to all rush the walls and then I want you to draw everybody back except Uriah the Hittite, who was this captain, the husband of Bathsheba. And of course, he's slain in battle. And David is called on by the prophet of God as, you are the man. He points the finger at him. And so David, in essence, commits murder and adultery, but he's still known as the man after God's own heart because of the other things he did and the forgiveness he asks afterwards and so on. So all the patriarchs are always shown to have these faults in the Bible stories. And you know, I'm spending a lot of time talking on biblical stuff. This is my training. This is my background. But these are the stories, the other ones I've been talking about, that really give us the basis for the biblical version of this reptilian subculture, or this reptilian beginnings. And this is what I think it all is. I think it's, if there is truth to all these stories, then the reptilians, if they exist today, it is an offshoot of all of this mythology, this religious mythology. If they exist today and you're not a believer in any of that, this is where the connectivity is. It's in our ancient mythologies show their beginnings. Can we prove they exist? No. David Icke will tell you, and many followers, you know, well, all you have to do. I was actually on a radio show last week and another host called in because he wanted to take me to task because he's a believer in the reptilian thing.
Oh, no.
And he's kind of yelling at me on there and, you know, how can you overlook this? And there's millions of photographs out there on the internet of people with reptilian eyes and so on. And I said, you know, I'm a Photoshop designer. I've been a Photoshop guru since 1989. And I'll tell you what, you give me a picture of a guy and his eyes, I'll make him look reptilian. You won't be able to know the difference. Mm-hmm. I said, I could do it in 5 minutes. I said, it's digital art. I said, it just does not exist. And if though any of those photos are real, I'd be surprised.
Right.
I'd eat my hat.
Agreed. And again, I say, when you look at the real players at the top of the pyramid in today's modern world and the way they're manipulating world events and affecting things, does it really matter if they have green skin or scales or reptile eyes? What matters is that we're being fucked, and at least to me.
Exactly. Well, I kind of put it this way. When I was talking in the book on the Nephilim, I said, if there is an alien race out there, reptilian race that has complete power over us, and I can use the word because you did, we're fucked. We have no control over it. If it's God, and it's exactly as the Bible says, and he has complete control over our destinies, and we have no way to conquer him, if you will, or go around him, we're fucked. In essence, either way, we don't own ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else controls us. And it doesn't matter how much 21st century psychological BS we want to spout. It all comes down to, we have no control over any of it.
Right.
If there is an alien race of reptilians here, do we have the ability to conquer over them? Hell, we don't even know they exist.
Right.
So how do we do that? So there you go. Maybe this is what the prepper shows are all about.
Right. Yeah, you got to get ready. Hey, man, Scott, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you and talking to you. I mean, a lot of these biblical stories are great. You know, your other book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, sounds equally as interesting, too. I mean, is there anything else out there that you want to tell the people about, your website or anything?
Well, you know, my website is just simply my name, ScottAllenRoberts.com, and Allen is A-L-A-N. So ScottAllenRoberts.com. You can see a link at the bottom to all of my books. I've got a new book coming out this October, The Exodus Reality, that we've talked about a bit. I also have Intrepid Magazine. You just go to intrepidmag.com, and we just had our 2-year anniversary. We publish a digital magazine, but it's not just another text website with a few pictures slapped up. We create the magazine as if it's going to the printing press, and then we burn it to a PDF. And you can load it into your viewers and your all the technology that's out there. And if I can give one really big plug,
sure.
Well, first we have the Paradigm Symposium, and if you like this kind of stuff, these are the things we talk about. This year we're focusing on Egyptology and ancient the ancient past. We've got a lot of speakers that focus on that. But we also have at Intrepid Magazine a Indiegogo site. It's a fundraising campaign, crowdsourcing, that we are really working hard to draw some more money in to be able to expand the magazine into print, expand it into greater digital resources, expand the publishing effort that we have going, and also the Paradigm Symposium. If you're so inclined, just go to intrepidmag.com. There's a widget on the right side. You can click on that to see our Indiegogo site. And if you like what you see, we'd love it if you could help fund us. As of today, we have 11 and a half days left on that campaign to try to raise what we're after.
Oh, man.
So there's a plug for something we're trying to do if you like this kind of thing.
Sure, yeah. And you might see me there with a vendor booth selling T-shirts.
That'd be great.
Well, all right, sir. You know, thanks again for taking the time to chat with me on my Stupid Stoner Show. Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Greg, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Well, take care, man. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
There you have it, folks. Another one in the bag. Anyone who wants to hear the gritty details should definitely pick up Scott's book. I thought it was a blast. Thanks again to you for listening. More and more people are sharing the show, which is great. We're well into the thousands strong. I couldn't be happier. Try to keep up with all the messages and reply to all of them. But honestly, if you have comments, just leave them on my Facebook wall. I'd love to respond and let other people chime in. I mean, I hate when someone asks me a serious question on Twitter because it's too fucking limited. I can't answer anything. So really, Facebook me. I'm easy to find. I love all you crazy guys and girls. Check out the t-shirts at conspiratees.net. I'd love to eat this week, and I'll see you Sunday. You're the goddamn best.